Welcome to the Quality Under Pressure podcast, a podcast that reminds you that a conversation is still a beautiful thing. My name is Min, joined by Scott, and today we are speaking with Lindsay, who I know from graduate school. And Lindsay is a friend of mine, just a beautiful person inside and out. I love her positive energy. I love her free spirit because I am so cranky and crusty, but you have such a youthful spirit. And it just feels like you are the type of person that's always doing something. Do you ever get tired, Lindsay?
Oh, yes. I abuse my mental health constantly.
Yeah. Well, I'm just thinking, like, we met in econ
nice
class. Of course. I mean, all of it, too. But, like, we met in econ class, and it was the one 8 a.m. class offered at our school. And there would legit be times where, like, you worked overnight, and you would come to this ridiculous 8 a.m. class. And I'm just like, how do you do it?
Man, I got really lucky with what I got really lucky that I have the, I guess, like the health that I did during that time. But I wrecked some of my serotonin receptors and stress receptors eternally from grad school because I was working probably 70 hours a week and then going to school full time. And that was not a good call. I've had a couple, I don't know if you saw this, but like the Peace Corps just got evacuated and I did Peace Corps and I even worked for their response program after grad school. So I'm really into that network. I know Peace Corps is kind of problematic and that's like a whole other conversation. But so I've been talking with a lot of the folks trying to come into the federal government work now who have been evacuated and kind of, you know, networking and saying, here's the positions that are available in our office because they're trying to make it possible for these people to get jobs and retransition in. And they all, everybody always asks me, they're like, well, should I just work full time during grad school? Like, what did you do? I always have to say, absolutely don't do what I did.
But that's the thing that I appreciate so much about you is you work yourself to the bone, but just like everything is a labor of love to you. That's amazing that, you know, you don't care. Like you just, you'll volunteer here. You'll go do this little side thing. And I don't know, you're always smiling, even though you worked 80 hours a week, have a full-time schedule at school and you're not sleeping. You still find a way to smile.
Wow, you're being really nice to me.
Because I would be so angry.
I'm trying to be less self-deprecating, so thank you.
Yes, yes, yes. And how are you, Scott?
I'm doing well. I'm envious of what you were able to do in grad school, by the way. I mentally struggle with just being like, could I even go back to school, like not work? So I'm always envious of the people that can like work a full-time job and then do school or do the MBA on top of raising a family. I just can't see myself doing it. And I have to applaud the people that can get through it. So well done.
Thanks. I will take that one.
Yeah. Also, this is it's going to be our fourth remote COVID-19 episode. And so obviously we sound a little different than studio quality, but also because we've always recorded in the studio, we've always interviewed people that live in Minnesota. But can you tell us like where you're at right now?
So I left Minnesota last year. I moved to Peru for 6 or 7 months to work. And then I flew immediately back to New York City to live. And now I live in Brooklyn. And I'm sitting in Williamsburg, 11211. Actually, it's really funny because that show that just came out on Netflix that's really popular, Unorthodox, is in my zip code about the Hasidic Jew community. So yeah, I'm sitting on the second floor off the Lorimer Street stop, chilling.
Because you're also like originally from the Midwest. Do you like it enough out there where you think it's going to be long term?
I don't know that, it's probably not feasible for it to ever be long term because New York has become so commercial and so inflated in price that it's just impossible to even, I mean, there's nothing wrong with renting for your whole life, but it's just almost impossible to buy any property here. I mean, that's a whole housing policy issue and zoning and yeah, it's so I don't know if I will. I actually, between you and I and Scott, I may be leaving for a different position internationally in the next 2 months. So,
do you know
the location?
Pretoria, South Africa.
Wow.
I've been offered a position to move to Pretoria, South Africa to work for a UN agency. So I may do that.
Congratulations.
Thanks. So we'll see.
Okay. So before we get into the COVID-19 questions, we always put new guests through a speed run question. So let's kick it off with, what's your favorite junk food?
A Jack's frozen pizza.
Excellent. Is that what's cooking right now?
No, we can't get them here.
You can't?
No, I talk about it constantly. Somebody sent me a Barstool Sports review of frozen pizzas, and they ragged on Jax because they asked Jax to send them some to do it, and Jax replied on their corporate Instagram being like, we can't do this right now. Like, good luck. We are really happy, but we are, like, fulfilling all of our orders to our regular distributors and, you know, like, let us know in the future. And the guy ragged on them.
Oh, what?
Yeah, in his Barstool Sports review. And I didn't ever like them to begin with because that's the same publication that, like, called Rihanna fat. Remember that? Like, eight years ago. So that's a good indicator. Anyways.
Jax is the ultimate value play. 4 for $10.
Yeah.
Oh, excellent. Yep. Okay. Good for them for keeping it real, though, man. They're like, hey, no bullshit. Like, we're just going to do our thing.
Yeah, I know. I kind of liked, and their response was really nice. And the guy was like, yeah, they were nice, but that's BS or whatever. I don't know.
High school celebrity crush.
I watched Across the Universe because I thought I was really intellectual deep when I was like 17. And there's that guy, Jim Sturgis, in it. And my friends and I used to record the scene where he's humming because he just looks so handsome in it and send it to each other like when we first had phones.
Love it. Are you a morning person or a night person?
Night person.
If you had to get a face tattoo, where would it be and what would it be?
It would for sure be permanent makeup. Who am I getting?
Yeah. Would you rather be able to talk 3 different languages or talk to animals?
The capitalist in me, which I'm not, would say talk to animals because you could make a really cool career out of that. But I also love talking to people. I would go with talking to animals, but I would not want it to, it would be like that Simpsons episode where the Simpsons have the monkey's paw and they become famous and then they realize that it's like Flowers for Algernon where it's actually terrible. So I think that's, talking to animals would be that bad, whereas you could continue to live a somewhat normal existence if you could speak 3 languages and like actually you'd open up opportunities to do good in other ways. Whereas if you spoke to animals, you'd be like celebrity, you know, you'd be like, the government would like lock you in a cage.
The foresight on this one. The foresight on Lindsay is amazing.
Right? They would keep
the
would
be like, person who can talk to animals would be locked in a cage. That's
for sure. They'd be like, all the secret. They'd be like, can you get, I mean, don't they do that? They always have those failed missions, or they're actually still going on where they have the trainers go and work with like the large sea mammals to do essentially like naval intelligence work.
Yeah. I think the Navy trains like dolphins to like check out like landmine or sea mines, sorry. But they do definitely train different animals. So
yeah, it would be impossible to not be sucked into the military industrial complex if you could talk to animals. So
like, especially like get this parakeet to go spy, right? Or get like this bird to go sit on the ledge and listen to this super interesting meeting.
Yeah, or get this gigantic stork to go like drop a grenade on somebody and like, I mean, you would, and the how that would weigh on you mentally would just be, you'd be gone. Your life would be over, even though it'd be really cool. You'd have to not tell anybody.
You'd have to be in secret. It would have to be in secret.
Yeah.
That's so true. I'm taking this question off of my list of questions now. What is your least favorite fashion trend?
Fashion trend or trend of preying on women from the time they're born to instill high culture in them?
Oh, either one. Either
probably
one.
That one.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, we've all struggled, men and women. But women get particularly targeted and they're particularly vulnerable to it because we cannot win. That we cannot win and we cannot do anything about beauty standards. So,
last one, are there more grains of sand on Earth or stars in the sky?
I don't know enough about either to... Well, does sediment count as sand? Well, are we just talking
technical answers?
Sand?
No.
The technical answer is no?
Yeah, sand is different than dirt.
When they're mixed, I guess I don't even know how much. I would say stars because we don't even know that's stars. It's stars.
Oh, I think it's I think you're looking for an opinion there, right, Min? There's no right answer there, right?
But we could get philosophical or technical or whatever too. So yeah, let's throw that one out there.
This podcast is called Quality Under Pressure, and I'm stressing.
Not quality
don't
under
worry.
Pressure, Lindsay over here.
The pressure will turn you into a
what
diamond.
Do you call that?
Okay, so let's dig into the COVID-19 questions. But I've been kind of framing this with a good or a positive first question. And so I'll ask you, what has been sort of the best change since this whole COVID-19 quarantine started?
I would say, in my personal opinion, the best changes are coin flipped with the worst things that we're seeing. So you guys are from the Midwest and you know what's going on in Wisconsin right now. There's a lot of protesting going on. And that has been driving me into a place of just so many feelings that I'll get to it later. But I would say the best thing is that folks are being thrust into having to think about where, sort of like where they place their empathy and how they choose to characterize it. And they're seeing how systems are designed to make things impossible that actually are really feasible, and how kind of support works and how state-sanctioned policy has real impacts on people. So I would hope that, and I'm going to choose to be hopeful, that there's a lot of enlightenment going on around what responsibility looks like during this time in terms of service and, yeah, like citizens' roles. And I like how many, and I, this might just be because I'm in an echo chamber of whatever I'm looking at, but all of the memes criticizing these useless PR statements from these like large-scale corporate entities. I don't know if it's just the people that I choose to follow who are putting that stuff, but I'm really happy that that's being challenged. And I'm really glad that folks are seeing kind of, or people are being put on blast kind of and saying like, you're mistreating employees during this time. And look at, we, you know, you're a public entity. We can see all these things that you're doing, yet you continue to like not be upstanding in terms of citizen and worker labor rights. And I'm really happy for that, that a lot of it's being put. I don't know that it's ever going to be permanent or stick forever because we have like a, you know, 6 second news cycle, but I hope so.
Yeah. So I'm hearing you appreciate sort of the social community awakening, and then maybe, you know, we're in a position where we can call bullshit a little bit better. But yeah. I was thinking the same thing. I had a conversation in the previous episode, and I asked them, you know, like, I agree with everything that you're saying, and you too, Lindsay. And I'm excited by that. But, you know, I'm thinking about just sort of the human psychology. And every new year, there are tons of people that say, this is the year where I get my health together, I get my fitness together. And then come February, that emotional buzz fizzles out. I'm like, yes, like this is the opportunity where how many times is something like this going to happen? Hopefully not that many times, but like, because that it did, let's make something positive out of it. But once we all go back to normal, like how long does that feeling stick?
I don't know, because there's probably been a lot of instances since like mid-80s tax reform that people have recognized that this growing wealth inequality that's been pretty consistent is only going to worsen with some of the 2017 tax reforms. In my personal opinion, I'm not a tax analyst, but I do engage with a lot of tax policy in my job. And I, as like a social policy person, it's in the cards. It's not like a mystery anymore. And I'm hoping that with growing, things are not ever going to be economically revitalized under certain political structures that we like still cling to, in my opinion. So I hope that the continued frustration with that breeds a lingering emotional response. But I also realize that people can't hold on to disappointment and frustration for that long because it's really tough. And it's really taxing to have to confront your own bias too. And folks that don't have a system of support or like access to those kinds of conversations or like essentially like resources or networks that are willing to sort of create mutual aid or like transformative, I guess liberation would be the word. It's probably not going to happen. So I don't know. We'll see.
Mm-hmm. You have something to chime in with, Scott? I see your gears turning a little bit.
No, I mean, she brings up a really good point, and I'm not as well versed as you guys. You guys are both poli sci masters, right? So
yeah, I would say we're interdisciplinary.
I did two masters, so I am interdisciplinary.
Oh, fancy!
I've never gotten to say that out loud, and I hate myself for having to say it. But just this one time, I'm trying to be kinder to myself, especially during quarantine, and say, "Oh, I did it."
You did it.
So I'm definitely a rube when it comes to all things politics and policy. So just preface that. I think Lindsay brings up a really good point about the challenging the companies as to like, okay, we're at that mesh point as to what's more important, human lives or the dollar, right? And we're seeing some companies almost put themselves ahead of the safety of the people, which is a really interesting impasse, right? It's a really interesting point to kind of observe kind of how companies deal with that, as well as our government and how we respond to that, tapering all the way up to like how we package the stimulus package and how much of that money is actually coming back to the people versus bailing out companies. So really interesting point.
Yeah.
I don't know how to galvanize people, because even that package is just like, you know, I saw people on Facebook, they were blaming like the Pelosi's and the people saying like, you know, they're blocking it so we won't get $1,200 once. And I'm just like, don't you want more? Like, don't you want to ask demand for more instead of like bailing out some of these companies? But they just thought, you know, it was the Democrats saying like politics matters before the common person, and like, they're holding it up because of that. And just like, I don't know, if somebody is in that position, I don't know. I just don't know what to tell people like that.
People who are in the position of
I don't know, because I thought, you know, and I could be wrong, you know, like maybe Pelosi and the Democrats were playing politics. I don't know. I looked at it as like, we want more of that pie to come to us, to you, me, my neighbors. I don't know. It's just like, because maybe it's just because I don't ascribe to the trickle down theory. And just like, I don't care if some of these big companies get a bailout right now. Like, the people need it more right now.
For sure. I hope that, and I see where you mean, because I think, especially right now, what's happening, Democratic Party and the DNC apparatus are just unfulfilling what I would think is like their commitment to justice in a lot of similar ways. I do think that this doesn't necessarily need a large scale study review to say that workers' rights or labor rights or even access to organize has been predominantly in policy implementation heavily in the pot of the left. So they have that going for them. But yeah, I also feel very cynical. We're really mad because a building next to us, New York City did a stop work order on all non-essential construction, right? And the building next to us is going to be like a luxury high rise in the most gentrified area of Brooklyn, Williamsburg. And whatever, I mean, I can't change zoning laws, but they were going on until like last week. And I found out finally, I did some researching, they got a stop work order, but they applied for a permit to say like, oh, well, we need to get it to this point before we can safely leave it in terms of like shutting down operations for a little while. And then I was reading a bunch about how in New York City that those essentially like emergency appeal stop work order requests went up by like 400% or some number that I don't even... And that made me feel really bad, because I also see that the majority of people working out there, it's all Hispanic guys who don't have PPE, or some of them do. I don't know anything about their, they all seem to be recent or like recent generational migrants. A lot of them don't speak English. And I just felt like this was so exploitative. Just felt, you know, like this luxury developer is not going to be the one to suffer the consequences. So
I'm dealing the same thing in Minnesota. I live right by the airport. And again, there's a brand new luxury apartment being built, and they have been working, you know, I think they're even working today. And my understanding, I don't know where I heard this, so this is kind of through the grapevine, but I heard with the essential work with defining with construction is there's no way to define what's essential in terms of building up for a hospital, right? Versus, you know, building a luxury apartment. I don't think those that are monitoring it are going to drill down and try to differentiate those two. So they're just saying, as kind of a whole, construction's essential because it could be used to build a new hospital, theoretically, right?
Yeah, that feels gross to me, but especially when people aren't, I mean, there's very little repercussions for folks that don't follow affordable housing regulations in terms of zoning. And so, and I mean, Williamsburg, even the middle income housing in New York City is so skewed. It's just housing for all is my point. Also, I didn't realize, are we allowed to swear on your podcast?
Yeah. Oh, fucks, yeah.
All right, super. I like to get permission, so.
Yes. Okay, cool. Any other positive changes since this all started?
Oh, see, that's what it is. I slide into that negative. That yin and yang. Positives. I guess it's bringing a lot of things out of the woodwork, and that's making me feel happy. And I hope that it spurs more conversations around Medicare for all or universal health care. And that's making me feel good because a lot of folks are like, I can't go to, I was supposed to get a medical clearance for a job that I was offered and I couldn't go, obviously, in New York City. And they ended up like letting me do some paperwork to waive it. But like, if it's not emergency, I had somebody I work with say, I'm pretty sure me, my husband, and my daughter had it, but the New York City hospital nearest to us just told us, and she lives in Washington Heights. She said, they just told us like, unless you're critically ill, you just have to wait it out. Hmm. Talk to our nurse triage and just good luck and stay hydrated, basically.
Drink some water.
Yeah.
Oh man. Well, I mean, that's, I think, you know, my intro to you, setting you up, like everything that I've asked you, like what's the best change? It's been about other people. And so I think that really highlights, you know, you are a truly genuine or a generous person. And so like, I'm glad that you're seeing some of these positive changes. I hope seeing external positive changes gives you internal happiness. I want some good things for you too.
Thank you for saying that. No, I recognize that my ability to even have this perspective sitting in my Brooklyn apartment is one that is based on certain factors that were beyond my control, that systems that were designed for me. And my only point of being on earth is to serve my community because my community has elevated me to a point where I can do these things. So, but thanks. But also for me, I'm trying to think of what's been good for me for this. my boyfriend and I have gotten to spend a lot of time together and it's been really nice.
Yeah.
I mean, we snap at each other, but for the overall, I feel really, that makes me really happy. We get to the point where we're so frustrated where we break into giggles, right? And that happens a lot and that's really fun. And yeah. And I have a track a block and a half away from me. So I've been running on the track.
Oh, excellent. Good, good.
Nice.
I'm going to throw the second question your way. And I mean, this is like, because this situation hasn't been easy for anyone. So this is like where the meat of the conversation happens. But what has been the toughest change for you? Let's start with personally.
Personally, the toughest change since this has all gone down is I'm being inundated with media. And a lot of that media either directly aligns or directly conflicts with some of my personal views on how people should be treated in a society from typically the state level or from a governing body level. And seeing all of this and managing those emotions and not having the typical outlets that I have, like a lot of times I can feel frustrated about something and then take the subway to work. And, you know, my mind kind of gets distracted, or then I get to go to work and I get to talk to other people and I get to bounce these things back and forth. But I don't like all the Zoom stuff. It just doesn't, it's great. I'm happy that people are able to talk and communicate. But for me, I just never feel as connected to people with it. And it's also like more of a barrier to talk to people. So I just miss talking to people and getting there. Like, you know, volleying these ideas back and forth and having these things. Instead, they all sit in my head and I don't want to pour those all onto the one person I live with. And so trying to manage that has been probably the hardest personally.
That's so true. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I love having conversations with people. I'm glad that we could do this through Squadcast and like, you know, I can still hold work meetings through Zoom, through Skype. But I don't know. It's just, maybe it's just the way I'm conditioned. Like I've just never been forced to connect with people and trade ideas this way. And maybe if I had grown up from, you know, the day I was born till now, sort of communicating with people this way, and then all of a sudden people were like, well, I don't know, go out into the real world and start communicating. I'd be like, what is that? And so it's probably a lot of it is conditioning, but there's just something so different about talking with someone, like face to face and like, you know, like this, we have to very intentionally take turns. Once I'm done, like someone else can hop in. But like when you're face to face, like, I don't know, there's just like visual cues or like, and like you can cut someone off and it doesn't feel as clumsy.
Yeah, I know. I think that probably speaks to like how we do a lot of things without intention. I'm addicted to Instagram. I follow so many things that I'm interested in that I will spend so much time on there just looking at nonsense. And yeah, like how when you're forced to have a conversation about that has really open-ended questions that are like interested. Man, you should be a social worker is what I'm trying to say.
Really? Dude, yeah. I thought about it, man. I just think like, you know, like I should have done the dual like you, because like policy is one thing, but like I'm in just so many meetings, and after a lot of the meetings, I'm just like, okay, like what are we gonna do? And it just wasn't that type of meeting. It's just like, let's talk about all these high level things. And then like we leave and then everything is the same. And I'm like, wait, aren't we meeting to like change something or fix something or do something? And I just love that like you're closer to the ground. Like you see the people that, you know, like, I don't know, like you're on both sides. And I'm just like, that's the way to do it.
That's why I would get so frustrated in grad school sometimes, because I would take out a lot of my own frustration, my own stressors on people that would reflect opinions that were like indicated to me probably wrongly because I was in a place that wasn't great, that they like didn't really actually understand that connection to that community, or that they were like designing something from the policy level that I had an issue with based on my experience. And so I would get really combative. So if anyone on this is listening and I yelled at you once during grad school or got real snippy, please forgive me. I'm sorry. I am really opinionated and I want to be kinder, but yeah, you should have been a social worker. I love how social work is the organizing arm.
Yeah, definitely at school, it was always the MSW, MPP duals, and then the human rights people were just some of the warmest people. And like anytime I had a chance to interact with you guys, I was just like, oh, like I'm probably going to melt in a second here.
I want to give you a hug. And I loved, I just want you to know that I loved when you were going over Korean language pronunciation. Because we're all going to be Korea. South Korea is going to be the next, I mean, we should all start learning Korean.
The next Hollywood. And
yeah.
Maybe.
The next thing. So I love, and I didn't know you knew all that. I knew that you spoke Korean, but I didn't know that you were at a, I guess I don't know anything about people's like family history or like heritage, where I don't know how many people are able to actually explain some of the linguistic aspects versus just kind of talk or whatever.
Yeah, no, I think that stuff is fun. So I was just like, oh, this is, I don't know. It was around the time of the Oscars and everyone was getting into Parasite. I'm like, well, this would be, you know, an okay time to do it.
Parasite, I loved it. It was so good.
It was so good. Also, like when you were talking about your first point about one of the toughest changes, you talked about, you know, like I could just go outside, like go to a place. Like the physical space, like the physical limitations of where you can go, that sounds like it's confining and it's trapping you a little bit.
Yes and no. I realize what a homebody I am. Like there's nothing I love more than staying in and taking the time to cook. And there's so many distractions in New York City. I'm really lucky to be able to live here, but I get exhausted just after working 9 hours and then going to the gym and then being on the subway. And by the time I'm home, if I'm home, I'm not going out again unless somebody is willing to come to my neighborhood. And like my closest friends here live, one of them lives a 45-minute subway ride away from me. I'm like, so yeah, yes and no. And I can still kind of go outside because people are just being really good about staying inside. It's actually something I've really liked is my neighborhood. There's definitely way less people walking around. And I genuinely feel, and this is based on no evidence, that people are staying in as much as they can, but taking their walks, and no one's like kind of abusing it. You can tell, and I'm doing that. I'm trying not to abuse it. You know, I'm trying to say like, well, I don't need to go to walk again, but
Yeah. I want to ask both of you guys the same question. Like when you were talking about that, you know, knowing some of your background, Lindsay, and hearing you say like, you know, you like going to different countries and exploring different things. And that's why I was kind of asking you, like, is the physical limitation feeling like it's suffocating you a little bit? I'll start with Scott. Scott, are you the type of person to go back to the same place over and over? Or like, are you more of a type of person that explores different things? Because for me, like Lindsay seems a lot more of an explorer than me. And so like, I've noticed more and more, like I find comfort in something and I just kind of return to it over and over, whether it's like restaurants or like circles of people. How about you, Scott? Like, do you find yourself exploring more or kind of going back to the same enclaves a little bit more?
Well, I want to open that question up a little bit. What's my objective with going to this place? Why am I going there? because I can see myself answering that question depending on what I'm doing. If I'm going to get my favorite pizza or my favorite beer, then I'm going to go back to the same place because I know that's my favorite, right? I guess, why am I going to this place?
Then I'm going to ask Lindsay, because this idea popped into my head, because when you were talking about what's the toughest change, you were speaking about, like, you know, it's just weird not being able to go, to go on a walk if I sort of need to clear my head and vent. Do you go to, like, these, like, new places and, like, go on walks when you need to clear your head and vent a little bit, as therapy, and, like, you like seeing new places?
I mean, I should, but I don't. I like it. That's the great paradox of all of this, well, happily changing culture around taking care of yourself. But we all know these things, yet the problem is, like, cognitively being able to do them. It's like going to the gym. Like, we all know, you know, everything, but the getting yourself there. I guess I do miss going to new things a little bit, and I don't do enough therapeutic. I have been running more at home. I bought new running shoes because mine are locked in my gym at my work because our building's shut down. It's downtown Manhattan, like 3 blocks from the World Trade Center. So we can't get anything. So I had to buy new running shoes. I guess it is really therapeutic, and I know it in my head, and I know how good I feel afterwards. Literally I'm laughing more. I'm not, everything is better.
How about this too? Like, when you begin traveling more and more internationally, are you able to pinpoint sort of the root motivator for that?
Motivator for general, like, discontent
or you said you've been to Peru, and all of that. And so, like, when you started doing sort of the international traveling and exploration, what inspired you to do that?
I like getting to know people from different places, and I like seeing how different places essentially, like, honor rights of individuals and how that plays out and why those systems, like those value systems that then translate into these larger, I guess you would say, like, political frameworks and legal frameworks and cultural frameworks. I just like it. I just feel really lucky that I've been able to, and it's really fascinating to me. And people are always so welcoming. This is what it is. Now that I'm talking out loud, I've gotten it through my head. I really, really feel a desire or a draw for communities that are strong. I didn't have a very strong community growing up, and I really always wanted one. I remember watching things like Sesame Street and watching things. Remember that show Gullah Gullah Island? Mm. And watching all these shows where people had these communities where they could talk and they could do all these things, and I never had that, and I always wanted it so badly. And I think part of it is, you know, cultural, based on heritage, and part of it is, I loved groups of people that I would get with. Like, I remember my study abroad group when I was in college. That was a community where I felt so welcomed, and I remember just being thrilled and feeling so excited by it. I'm always seeking that, I know. And I should also put a disclaimer out that I have a wonderful partner that is always willing to give me that. And as soon as I, like, leave out and go out and try to find it somewhere else, I recognize that, like, when I left Minnesota, moving to New York was really hard because I had finally built a community in Minnesota of people that I felt like I could do anything. It's just so empowering to have all these people where if you are confused about something or you want to get into a new career, like, you have all, you know, that you can talk to people and they'll try to help you. And it's just this amazing thing. So that is what it is. Is I'm always seeking community.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. Like, you, like, one, I think early on you were talking about, to me, what I heard was, I like learning things and seeing new things, but also that connection piece that you're getting towards a little bit later. And maybe that paints the picture and the context a little bit better for you, Scott. Because to me, Scott, you've always been someone that has always surprised me every time we've had been able to have, like, a deeper conversation, and, like, you'll bring some gem from this corner and some gem from that corner, and I'm like, geez, like, who is this guy Scott? Like, I thought I knew you, but, like, you always surprise me. So I'm like, who is this guy? So I've always felt like, you know, like, you're a little bit better at finding different things that maybe people that know you don't necessarily attribute, but you know about something that we don't see on the surface.
And thanks for that, man. That's quite the compliment. I think Lindsay touched on it. I also did study abroad as well. And when you go and experience new things, I think there's a risk involved with, I think there's one, a more of an effort to go do it, right? To go find it. More things can go wrong, right? But then there's also the opportunity that it could disappoint you, right? But at the same time, when you study abroad or you do something new, it opens up your perspective. And that's what it ultimately comes down to for me when I experience my new things, whether it be studying abroad, going to see different cultures, is an understanding of the bigger picture. And, you know, I was fed the narrative, you know, before studying abroad that America's the best and the way we do everything is the best, right? But then analyzing the governments and the culture of, you know, Europe, you start to just compare and be like, well, maybe America's not the best here and there. And, you know, gaining that perspective and opening your mind that way, I think is invaluable. So that's my kind of touch on that.
I also feel like what we're converging on is that we all want a place to where we all want to get to a place where we can feel really vulnerable and simultaneously be held, whether it be emotionally or, you know, intellectually or whatever, and feel secure. And I think that, I mean, we're probably getting into attachment theory by then.
Dude, yeah, that's really great to hear Scott say that too. There's just something about like American exceptionalism. We get so caught up in the idea that like we are the best or we have to be the best. And like, what does that mean? Like, it's like we do that in so many different spheres. Like, I'm a huge basketball fan, and constantly, you know, there's that debate of like, is Michael Jordan the best or LeBron James the best? And like, clearly they're two of the greatest players, but like, they just did different things. And so like, you should just appreciate it for that. And you know, like, there are things that, you know, here in the United States we do well, but then like you said, like I lived abroad in South Korea for a year, but like when I was over there, like I clearly saw that they did some things very well too. Like when I was just like, I was a fish out of water when I went to a clinic there. Like I got a probably, you know, worse than average cold, and it was just time to go there. Like all my Korean friends were like, even like weeks before, they're like, dude, just go to the hospital or go to the clinic. And I was just like, I just had that American sentiment of like, you know, I'm not going to go to the hospital or clinic until this actually gets to a point that justifies me going. And they're just so much better at preventing it getting worse. And like, I don't know, I was just so conditioned in like, I don't want to like do the co-payment, do the paperwork and all of this and get there and then realize like they can't do anything for me. But like, I finally went, you know, I show up and they're like, oh, like I just need to see a doctor for my cough, my fever, blah, blah, blah. They're like, oh, okay, like have a seat. And before my ass could touch the seat, they called me into an office, like 10-minute checkup. They're like, you need this medicine, paid $3 and left. I'm just like, oh my God, like that's how easy it is here.
It's crazy. Yeah. I mean, yeah, what folks are willing to do to say, like, I don't want to spend $130 to go to urgent care and have somebody tell me, oh, you just have a cold, you have to go home, drink fluids. You know, like that's it, I'd rather call this relative that has a partner or this relative who is a medical professional and just kind of get their opinion on it. And we rely on those informal networks. And but that's not real community too. Yeah.
Well, also, have you guys found like when I spent time there, you know, it's, I mean, I have Korean parents, so that brought me a little bit closer. But like when you go to different places and it's quote unquote foreign and like you're kind of bracing yourself for like this shock, like there's so many times where when I challenge myself to do something new and I meet the people there, I just kind of like realize, like, oh, like we're not that different. We're the same, and we're like going after the same things. And that, I don't know, that just that lesson, I need to be reminded of it over and over and over again. But it just makes me feel so warm inside and less scared of the world.
Yeah, I feel that way for a long time. I held on to beliefs that, you know, we didn't have a computer in my house growing up, like until I was 11 or 12 years old. So, I mean, I always held, and I grew up in a really conservative area. I think it's probably one of the most conservative areas in Wisconsin. And it, I held on to,
Whitefish Bay.
no, Waukesha County, but close.
Okay.
And when I would, this is really embarrassing to even say out loud, but I guess it's probably well timed. when I reached a point where I actually started working with individuals that I had held on to some biases about based on like socioeconomic status or where they placed themselves in the society or the actions that they took. And I started to see that, wow, if I had been in this person's shoes, I would have done the exact same thing. I am not impervious to propaganda. I'm not impervious to cultural settings that may or may not empower people. I'm not impervious to like systematic discrimination or systematic structures that harm people or push them in certain directions or, you know, like block them from having access to certain things. And working with people who are, especially people who are in, when we talk about like the poor, right? Like people who are in poverty or intergenerationally impoverished. There were just so many things that I had to learn, and only through really trying, and that's insane even saying this, like that I even had a belief that these people were somehow implicitly less than me in any way. That's so fundamentally flawed, and that's not the message I want to get across, but trying to understand why people would do things that from my perspective would be like, well, why would you do that? And then get to a place of saying, oh, no, I totally understand where you're coming from, and I see it now. Yeah.
Implicitly less. I also want to throw in, I think a lot of people feel they're responsible for their circumstances too. And so many times that's not the case.
Right. And so that the reason this is all going through my head and I realize I keep pulling this back towards this point is that I'm so frustrated with what's going on in Wisconsin right now. I'm just so bothered by it.
That's what we're here to, like, again, like, I just want you to express your thoughts and we'll go into, that's why Scott's here too, because anytime I have a conversation with him, Scott is not one dimensional. And so like, let's talk about anything that's on your guys' mind. And I don't know, I just love doing this. So
Am I talking more than Scott too much? Am I?
No, Scott's a co-host. Scott's a co-host.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. For a second.
No, you are on the shrine right now. So
Scott, how much time? Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to ask, since you are in Brooklyn, Lindsay, I just want to ask about the situation, obviously, in New York City is a little different than Minneapolis. And one thing that kind of shocked me when I first saw it was the mass burial site that they're building on Hart Island. I just want to know how that affects you, what your thoughts are on that, and just, I guess, any kind of just perspective on the New York view of COVID and kind of how things are getting handled out there.
I would say the most horrifying thing is that we still embrace our current prison system. I think that our current prison system should be completely abolished. And the idea that a manifestation of that is these folks who are being not paid but incarcerated to have to do this kind of work that's so traumatic, and they don't have access to a facility with healthcare. I mean, that is a whole trajectory that's the thing that's most bothersome to me. That made me the most sad. I recognize that bodies do have to, from like the healthcare perspective, I don't know enough about how typically that works to be able to comment on it. But yeah, it makes me really sad too. And I hope that it draws attention to just how bad some of the prison conditions are, and that those aren't a reflection of just poor management of these particular prisons in a otherwise functional system. It's all interconnected. How we choose to like sanction certain institutional violence on people in prisons. So that made me the most sad it was kind of traumatic and horrifying to see like, wow, this is where they bury bodies. That wasn't as upsetting to me as seeing the fact that prisoners were doing it. But New York is, yeah. And it's so weird that it's not weird, but it's so interesting that in Manhattan and all over Brooklyn, all over Queens, where I'm living, that these hospitals are under so much stress and under, like, I subscribe to a lot of kind of like social work networking circles, and they've had a lot of calls for people, but I don't have my license for New York State, so I can't help. And I tried to, and they were like, sorry, right now we're not taking anybody without their New York license. So we'll let you know if that changes, because they just need help with outpatient discharge for people that are like recently infected, because they can't afford to keep them. I think it was happening in hotels. They were like, I saw a job posting that I responded to that was like, we need people to go to these hotels in Queens and Brooklyn to work with these folks get them home and just do essentially like outpatient like treatment plans or kind of hospital social work. And that was really interesting because it's so quiet on my block. And if I didn't read the news or if I didn't, it would just be a lot of restaurants have shut down. But other than that, it's just been kind of sleepy in my block. So, and I, and my neighborhood is one that's pretty gentrified, but also has one of the highest infection rates. But I guess we don't even know if that's true based on how infection or positive test results are being, you know, like those, I don't, I'm sure an epidemiologist would have a better idea of how accurate those numbers are, but we're one of the worst affected. Oh no, hang on. I got to get my phone or my computer charger. Shoot. Hang on.
Okay. Yep. Yep. Dude, that's a great question, Scott. I'm glad that you asked that because it's like, we're all here. Like, let's leverage like a New York perspective.
And that's the thing is like, you can read about it as much as you want through a news medium, but there is something better about getting a firsthand perspective from someone who's living it, right?
Yep, totally. No, don't be.
Yeah, but my perspective is that I just feel really, I feel kind of guilty. I feel like I don't know what to do with myself because how can I be of help? So I've been trying to spend like all of my money supporting small businesses. It's been really hard to find. I follow a lot of mutual aid networks through essentially political organizations like PSL and DSA, and they have done a really good job of creating these mutual aid relief funds. I'm sure there are others, just the ones that through networks I'm like tapped into, but I've been trying to order like from, you know, small businesses. I've been trying to order from artists, you know, like buy stuff. I actually had a really high credit card bill, even though I'm not even riding the subway or doing anything because I'm trying to spend all this money. And I just feel kind of, I guess, disempowered. I feel powerless.
Mm. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's tough. That's, I mean, just kind of, I don't know what to say. Like there's no real answer. One thing I don't want to leave this thought, but like, as you were talking about it, like one thing that made me sort of, you know, I don't know, admire you even more is like on your free time, you're like looking for like volunteer requests and stuff like that. And teach someone like me that, you know, there's so many times where I'm frustrated with what's going on and I don't know how to respond. Like, at least like you're over there, like looking for like, can you help us do these things? And like, you're saying like, you know, just the only barrier, the major barrier for you was that, you know, you don't have your license out there. Like I'm the type of person that like sees something, I'm like, oh, head scratcher. Like, I wish I could do something more. And then like 10 minutes later, I find myself playing video games. But like, you're so proactive about things. Like, how do I get there?
Wow, that is a compliment. But I do the exact same thing.
Okay.
Like, for stuff for an hour or two. I've only done a little bit of volunteering at a church that made meals. For people, they typically do like food trucks to food banks and shelters. But this time they were doing it for healthcare workers because they were so, like, nobody had any food. So I did that. But I guess part of it is that part of my personal relief is feeling like I'm part of a community and I really miss service work. I just think that that's where I meet the people that inspire me the most and that make me feel like, but I'm also, this is also reflective of the fact that I've gotten this weird, like, capital induced idea in my head that if I'm not being productive, I am somehow not worthy. Like that, this is, I have a self-worth issue, clearly, just hearing myself. Because people should be allowed to rest. And when they're under these incredibly traumatic circumstances, and I've acted like really fucked up a few times. I freaked out at somebody on Instagram. Some girl tried to sell me like, I don't know, like a diet plan, like unsolicited, like somebody I didn't know who started following me. And I just was like, dude, as a mental health professional, this is so fucking inappropriate that you would do this. Like, never do this to somebody again during this time. And like, I was like, it is not helping to like frame the idea that if you're thinner, you're somehow more successful or happier. Like, that's never okay. And to do that during this time is so like horrific to me. And I kind of laid into her and she said, like, you're really mean. And I said, I'm not being judgmental. I'm just letting you know that this is really, really, you should really reconsider this. This is a terrible idea. So I am far from being like the really nice. And I feel really bad about that. So if that girl's listening, I still condemn what you did, but I didn't mean to be harsh. So,
yes.
And I didn't personally attack, but I felt really angry. And I let a lot of anger out in that one moment. So I still have no control. I have no self-control is my point. Like none of us do, but I just that kind of work.
I loved your point about this needing to feel like you're being productive, like the benchmarks and the metrics of what it is to be productive. I think, you know, that's all we've been taught. And I think a lot of those are incorrect. Like so much of it about is like input, like how many hours are you at work? Like how many hours have you volunteered? It's so much of it is about the input that you put in. And just like, well, what if that generates actually no output? And just like, you know, like even when we talk about the economy, like I think money fucks up our way to evaluate because it's such a convenient, like numerical way of accounting for something. But like money is a proxy to so many things. And I think it's a very poor proxy for if humans are thriving or if humans are happy. And so like if our metrics could capture like how happy you are or how like well like a community is doing. The issue is like that's just so hard to quantify. So like we think like what's the next best way to quantify? And it's like GDP or like how much money goes to do something. And so like it's part of it is being lazy. The way we evaluate things are lazy, and so we get conditioned that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, and they're top down too. Like that's talking about productivity and talking about like how it's tied to money brings up a whole nother aspect of this horrible mess is just how much care work that is traditionally gendered is undervalued, both financially and as we see it now, what would be the word, like existentially or like intrinsically valuable. It's just, I mean, you can't put a price on these. I mean, what is it? One in every three women's careers is considered essential. More so the numbers I wouldn't know, but I do know enough about having done social work and that social work is also like a gendered profession where people tend to look at it as, I don't really know. I've heard some things, but I've heard things that have been completely wrong, and it's majority of women in social work. And then, I mean like nursing, medical professionals that may or may not be, it's just so obvious. And yeah, I hope that people start to recognize. It would be nice for everybody to recognize that the value of utility to a society is not one that's just based on output or financial value, which also changes over time, all the time, even with gender. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then, I don't know, I'm just thinking like making someone else smile. And we talked about human connection a lot. Like that to me is so much more valuable, but like what I value and the value system of society at large is so mismatched. And so like even like saying that out loud is just like, oh, you just sound like a hippie or whatever. But like think, like it's just like pause and think, like what is more valuable than that? So I just think about, you know, all the times that you made me feel secure in grad school. And Scott and I have known each other since high school, but like after college, really, like there's like a 4 or 5 year gap where we didn't really talk to each other, but like we sort of reconnected when you came back and you're like, hey, you want to go meet up for coffee? And it's your story, so I'm not going to share it here, but like you opened up to me. You were so vulnerable with me when we got coffee. And I'm just like, dude, like if Scott can open up to me that way, there's no reason why I can't tell him anytime I'm super bummed out or like I just need to like get something off of my chest. And so like that sort of connection that you can have with someone, that is so invaluable. Like I cannot put a price on it.
Yeah. And that's cool too. Cause when you get into like in the Humphrey School in political or I guess policy /nonprofit/ social work is like, how do you measure engagement? And at least now there's there's like a concerted effort to try to redefine those metrics and say, how do people feel like an organization or an entity is actually engaging with them and that they have some level of like public participation that isn't just tokenism. So I think that's slowly spreading, but I'm mad that it's not fast enough because I think everything should be community-based and participatory and rights-based.
Nice.
And the closer we get to there, the more freely we'll be able to feel like we can be vulnerable with people mm-hmm. and without, yeah.
Yep. I'm going to throw the third question your way. I mean, we've already talked about a little bit, so we might get to the final question pretty quickly here. But what has been sort of the most interesting observation for you?
I'm trying to think. Am I taking too long on this? I'm talking.
No.
Interesting observation would be, I guess even people coming out of the woodwork and saying, being so close to getting the point, right? Like being so close to being like, you're almost there of understanding what the influence these industries have on you that nobody would ever not sacrifice your life for a bottom line. That has been, and I've seen people that are, I can see it happening like on social media and in conversations where folks are starting to sort of recognize a little bit of it. And I think some of the rage is like misplaced, just like general, economic frustrations, right? Like that's been the most interesting, is people that I wouldn't have expected from my region of the world, from Wisconsin specifically. I'm seeing some turning of the tides a little bit. And I'm also feeling really happy because politically some things just happened in Wisconsin that give me a lot of faith and hope for citizens' rights.
Damn, you guys are making me really want to not visit Wisconsin.
I know, I'm crazy.
Are you talking about the Supreme Court?
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm disappointed about the Marcy's Law, but I kind of knew that was going to happen because of the way that they worded it on the ballot. But okay. I just feel a lot better because folks were willing to go out and vote in this like catastrophic failure of governance. Milwaukee County is a city of over 500,000 people, and they had 5 polling places in the whole county.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, I like the one term that you threw out there was, or one phrase that was just like the misplaced rage. Mm-hmm. I think that's really good because, we've been seeing the sort of protests in front of the governor's office here in Minnesota. And, you know, people are out there talking about, you know, like, let us go back to work, let us go back to work. And to me, that's misplaced rage because just like, it's great that I see them organizing. I see them protesting and standing up to authority. But like they're asking for the wrong thing. And it's just like, it's not that you want to be able to go back to work in shitty conditions. It's like, it should be, you know, like build a better system and value labor. And like, that's what you should be out there fighting for. But it's just like so easy to again, like part of me also sympathizes because when they see the number in their bank account going down too, they're like already doing the calculus. Like I have 3 weeks left until something bad is going to happen in my life. Like I need, and I think we're conditioned to think the response to that and the solution to that is I need to work. I need to work. I need to work. But like, it's like no one should have to live paycheck to paycheck. And like, you shouldn't be 3 weeks away from saying like, I need to walk this line between getting really sick and doing something that's really bad and being able to work. And so like, to me, that's misplaced rage right there.
Right. And I'm really reconciling how to extend my own level of empathy because I've been there. Like I've seen that happen to my family. I know how scary it is. I know what it's like to like literally not be able to afford a place to sleep at night. Like I get it. And I feel so bad, but I also have like this underlying judgment of like, well, yeah, this, I'm so glad that people are practicing civic engagement and being willing to like stand up for their rights and protest. But I'm so angry that it took something that only affected your income. And maybe that's just the whatever, but it's upset me this much to see these. I mean, when Black Lives Matter, when they wanted to do large scale protests and what people had to say about that, or when people had opinions about the legality or access to legality over immigration status, let's all fight for each other's rights, or let's quit chipping away at these social safety nets or these abilities to unionize or collectively bargain as the workers who are creating all of the wealth through our labor. And I know this is getting Marxist, but wouldn't it be great if we could just do that? And it does. I mean, it's hard for me to separate the two, and I need to recognize that they can exist at the same time, as I can be like, that's awesome, and I feel so much sympathy for you. But more of my brain power is going towards kind of like the frustration of like, this is what people have been saying for so long. And it's not these distracting issues of whatever is going on the news cycle that's controlled, but just it's deeper. It's more inherent. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm trying to, as I get older, I'm definitely much better at simultaneous, like accepting things that happen simultaneously. And so like, you know, when we see those videos of people protesting in front of the governor's place, a lot of it is like, oh, like at least my circle, my first ring in my ecosystem is, look at those dumb Republicans like asking to like die. And like, part of me is like, yes, that's true. But like, also like, you know, this, if you put on your like sort of social economic lens, it's just like, I get the fear that they feel too. And they're working class people, and that doesn't make them any different than I am. And so just like, part of me sympathizes, and just like, again, that's why when you said misplaced rage, it made me think of that entire situation, because once I was able to identify that, and where like, I can also agree with my enclave, and I'm just like, man, that what they're doing is so stupid, but then also put myself in their shoes and think like, they need help too.
It's, yeah, just, I mean, it's not, and for, yeah, I could go on about it forever.
any thoughts before we go to the final question here, Scoo?
No, I'm definitely enjoying just absorbing this conversation. It's definitely enlightening for me. You guys are talking a lot about things that I don't usually think about, which is nice to hear.
Well, that's probably nice of you to say, but I recommend it's somewhat obnoxious that we're using like purely academic organizing terms and being like, why don't people see it this way? But I can see myself. I can see the hippie stuff I'm saying. Well, actually not hippie, because I think a lot of it's actually rooted in or like embedded in real political analysis, but also, or I guess social analysis, not political. But yeah, right. Also I can see that it's, I can see why people don't like listening to this, because they say, all right, well, tangibly, how can I convince? And that's been like the great schism of 2016 elections, is like, how do I get through to people about something without coming off as condescending or coming off as whatever?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's why, again, like, I appreciate Scott, and because he can listen to things and just absorb it into, like, the other night, Scott, like you brought up, what was the chain? Supply chains.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, dude, that's dope. Like, that's not something I think about. So when you talked about, you know, medical supplies and different supply chains, I was just like, dude, that was my turn to shut up and soak it in. So
I love hearing about people's careers when they're like enough engaged with it to have even just like a conflict or an opinion about something. I love hearing people's stuff like that.
same. I'm going to throw out the final question here. And again, like so many times, like people already touch on some of these questions. But what do you think the new normal will look like once this is all said and done?
I don't know. I'm trying to think.
It's so hard. Also, like, there's no timeline. So I think that would be like a good indicator if someone tells you, like, what do you think life would look like 9 months from now? But I don't know. Like, and also, like, how do you define normal? Like, is being able to go to the park whenever you want and not have to think about 6 feet away from other people, is that normal? Or like, once we all get back into the office? So I don't have any indicators for you, but I don't know. What does the world look like in 6 months?
Here's something we haven't talked about, Min, that I definitely want to bring out there, is the understanding of just privacy in terms of your own kind of biology, right? Like, we take a look at China, and they're measuring temperatures in public everywhere you go. And just, you know, I was reading an article about the possibility of a government kind of controlling, you know, I guess everyone's like temperature, or, you know, tracking if you cough to maintain or prevent, you know, the spread of a disease, right? To prevent the COVID tragedy of 2020. It's interesting seeing that lens and being like, well, is our personal data in terms of, you know, our biological systems almost at a compromise here in the future? I'm just wondering what you guys think of that and kind of where that could possibly go. Because that could be a new norm, right?
That's actually a really good conspiracy too, is how the privacy structure is going to be forever changed from this too. I mean, Edward Snowden's been saying this stuff forever. And if you guys listen to The Intercept at all, or you read any of their journalism, I actually think it's really good. But how the surveillance state has grown and like amassed this power, and just, it's really funny because right before I got on this podcast, my boyfriend Sean was talking to me and he showed me this article, and it was something that he had told me about months ago, where I was asking him, I was like, he works in tech, and I, full disclosure, if I sound really silly, so be it. I mean, I don't know enough about it. He was telling me that about some of the cyber attacks that they've had on information management systems, and how to, and that it was possible to like place a cell phone on a tabletop, right, where there's also like a computer running. And even if that computer has never connected to the internet, I know there's a right term for that, but I don't know what it is. That just by being able to like interpret the sound of the PC fan operating in certain rhythmic sections, that you could extract a certain level of data. And he just showed me an article about it today where some people did it.
Wow.
And it was like, they were able to extract data from just a PC fan, and like through reverberations or whatever the,
right,
I know I'm not using the right terminology, but like that alone, and think of just how much everybody's been online recently too. And how much folks, I mean, even the 23andMe blows my mind that people are willing to send out the stuff that they know people are selling the information for.
Yeah.
So.
And then to connect that back to like, you know, containing a an epidemic, right? You could, I mean, if a cell phone can hear a, you know, laptop computer fan, what's to distinguish that from tracking, you know, the rhythmic of a cough, right? Or how hard they're coughing, or even, you know, we're all wearing, you know, Apple iWatches, which track heartbeat monitors. Just the information that I guess can be surveilled, and then I guess monitored, right?
Yeah.
I'm having a hard time, like, even just wrapping my head around this, because it's, I just, not something that I really thought of. Like, you know, people think about, I think a lot of people think about, you know, when I order something off of Amazon, or, you know, when my Google Home is listening to me when it's not supposed to, like who gets that data and all of that. So like, those are things that we've thought about, but just to hear like Lindsay's example of like, you know, if you have a cell phone even close to something that's not actually connected, and it just listens to the pulse of the fan, and that allows it to like, that's data, that's valuable data to somebody, like that's insane. Like, what if like people are going to figure out, if people want a certain piece of data, man, they are going to find a way to do it, like no matter how difficult it is. And so like when it comes to like our bodies, like you're saying, like, you know, like what if like health insurance companies want to know like how our hearts beat, and they're going to jack up like premiums and stuff in that way. I'm just like, that's great, because it's just, when you put it that way, I'm just like, wow, like something that's biological, they can do that too. Like there's no end. There's no end to this then.
And when you when you start to commodify it.
Exactly. So it's like, the reason we introduced it was to spread an epidemic, but now there isn't an epidemic in the last 10 years. Well, let's track how Scott laughs and what he laughs about, right?
Yeah.
And now that information gets sold to a marketing firm, and then it's commoditized, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's, yeah, I mean, I've already lost the Instagram algorithm. I like to try to trick it every once in a while, but I've already, like, they have pushed me things where I'm like, I mean, none of us should be using Facebook or Instagram, but I've already like fell victim to like, oh, I do really like those shoes.
Yes.
How do you know I only wear Huaraches?
Yeah, sometimes I think Facebook doesn't know me as well as it should, because like, maybe I'm just like an extreme dude or something, but sometimes I'm just like, I think they think I'm like Glenn Beck or something.
I know. I always feel this slight satisfaction when they push me something that they know that I absolutely despise. Cause I'm like, like this, you know, I think you are.
Yep. Also, like when Scott was first asking that question about like, you know, like the pros and cons, is like, could this be a good thing to always sort of be able to monitor how healthy, or like what people are thinking or their tendencies. The first idea that popped into my head was like, oh yeah, like I hope they do that, because like, you know, it's been pretty easy being like, in terms of ethnic minorities, like at least I got dealt the right one. Like, you know, like it's been pretty easy being an Asian person. But like, I live in a pretty white neighborhood.
Wait, and has
like,
it been pretty easy being an Asian person?
I think so. Like, I don't know. Like, I've never experienced anything.
But
I've never experienced anything else. Like, if somebody asked me, like, hey, do you want to trade in, like, being an Asian person for, like, a white person? Like, I probably would make that trade. But, like, yeah. I'm just thinking about, like, it's been pretty easy. But, you know, I live in a pretty white neighborhood. And, like, I can't go to the gym or do anything like that. So, like, my form of exercise has been to go on walks and runs around the neighborhood. And I don't know, man. This is, like, the first time in my life where, like, when I walk by a guy with, like, a baseball cap on and like he's cleaning his F-150 and he's got like his camo pants on, like this is me obviously projecting a certain image and already making assumptions about that person's personality and ideology, but I just get I'm so nervous. I just feel like I'm a Second Amendment person away from like getting into some confrontation. And so like when I go on my runs, man, I do it with sunglasses on. I put like a hat on, and I just like I'm just like oh my I it took me a while. I'm like why do I feel like I have to do that? And I was just like oh I'm just scared of getting beat up, and I'm just like it took me so long to come to terms with that. But I'm just like that made me so that made me think like another friend a brown friend was saying like you know like he doesn't like what's happening to Asian people, but I kind of told him like dude. At this point, you owe us nothing because I don't see, like when the stuff like this happens to black and brown people, I don't see Asian people think like I should come to their rescue. Like, so in that sense, like we don't deserve any sympathy from like black and brown communities.
I guess if you want to measure it that way, yeah. First of all, I'm sorry that happened to you. That's horrific. And no one should have to feel that way when they're in their community. And yeah, I think it brings up a good question of like not necessarily codifying like who's deserving of more empathy or sympathy, but hopefully that it encourages us to like evaluate where our sympathy is going and like when we hear certain groups speak, what level of consideration we give them. Because I think that's the real crux of our implicit and explicit bias towards certain groups is we hear certain groups like the ones that are very noisy right now saying, you know, we have a right to economic security and our future, our children's future is at stake. And that does gain a level of sympathy from a lot of people who are like, well, I do feel bad. Yet we hear the same, we knowingly have research that, you know, folks in predominantly black neighborhoods don't have equitable access to federal funds for housing justice. Yeah. And we know that, or, you know, in school systems, or they're denied at a higher rate that's not due to chance. Like that's, I worked in that lab, like that's, and yet we don't, when we hear these certain organizing efforts from those communities say like, we're not being given our, you know, we're not getting the level of consideration from like the, I don't even know what you would call it, like media sphere or even like just social sphere isn't equal. And hopefully that brings something good out of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sorry, man. That's. Yeah.
No, don't be. It's not your fault. I get what you're saying. And I don't know, like sometimes I always have to remind myself or like at least think about like, is that an overreaction? Because nothing has happened to me. And so like sometimes I get worried that, you know, I'm human. I have biases. And sometimes like the availability heuristic, like, you know, like you just hear about and you see it so many times. And you wonder like when it's going to be you next. And so like, think about all the times, like when an airplane disappears or crashes, like you hear about those stories like three times in a month. And you just think like the next time I hop into a plane, that's going to be my plane. But you know, statistically, like it's probably not going to be your plane. And so like, I always have to remind myself, like that's probably, I mean, it's probably more real than it's ever been before in terms of Asian people being assaulted, but also I have to remind myself, like, it's part of what's going on up here and the psychology that's bouncing around in my head.
No, I think that's super real. I think the level of gun violence is not under debate in terms of statistic probability. And also having lived all these years as a woman, we have ingrained that into our way of thinking too, because it's interesting that so many women support Second Amendment gun rights when the majority of being the person who's a victim of homicide by intimate partner violence with a gun is so great. And that's, I think Johns Hopkins just did an article about that too, about how it's really confounding. But yeah, like just being safe at night and feeling like you're under attack and yeah, I don't know.
That's a great point. I didn't even think of like, I was, you know.
Oh, I wasn't putting that as like undermining your point by any means.
No. I was only attacking. I was going to tack on like, that's such a good point because, you know, when I feel that way, when I go on walks, my mind automatically jumps to, these are how my Black and brown friends feel when things are normal. But like being a man, and like being sort of myopic that way, like I didn't think about this is how women feel at 1 o'clock in the morning on a weekend when they just wanted to like go have some fun with their friends. This is their normal, and like this is my normal right now. Yes. But I don't always have to live or always feel this way. So that's another group that I should have thought of, but I just didn't.
Yeah. I think macro view, we're really just analyzing how this horrible event is bringing to light all of these sympathy or empathies or considerations that we should be investigating and sort of like remediating to be more equitable based on the knowledge that we have. But I know that a lot of the knowledge that's out there is sort of propped up by nefarious actors. I said from the start, I hope I don't sound conspiracist, but
don't worry. Any final thoughts, Scott?
Again, interesting just to hear that conversation. I was just thinking about just the xenophobia, not only in the States with Asian Americans, but also what's going on in China right now. About, they just kicked out a bunch of like American reporters, right? And there's a lot of xenophobia about, you know, I guess the Muslims. And I just heard a story about a McDonald's in China that wasn't allowing Black people inside. Like, that's how bad it is over there. So it's interesting to just open that door on just, I guess, mistreatment and the xenophobia, not only within our borders, but what's going on a global scale as well. It's kind of disheartening, in effect, to hear a new story about not letting a certain color into a mall or a McDonald's. It just feels like such a step back. So that's what I was thinking about when you guys were discussing that. Lindsay, did you see the movie Bombshell?
No, I haven't watched it yet, but I loved Charlize Theron's makeup from the previews.
Yeah, I watched it recently, and that gave me interesting perspective on women in the workplace. And obviously we all know about Fox News and just kind of how they operate there. And that was definitely enlightening. I definitely recommend it. It was definitely interesting seeing the inner workings. Just, I know it's Hollywood, but you still get kind of a little bit of an insight into how Fox operates, and interesting seeing just, again, just the blatant sexism and just gender policy that I guess a media corporation implies from the top down, right?
I know, it's everywhere. I have had to, as a 28-year-old woman, report federal employees for sexual harassment. It's just bananas what people, where I am like, who does that? Like, it's just on myself. And it's, I mean, like, that's totally inappropriate. It's everywhere. Yeah. And it's very rarely explicit, but when it is explicit, we report it. It's more so in just those very subtle, I guess, yeah, like consideration. Like, is this person knowledgeable? Is the way that they're presenting this somehow conditioned by their gender? And if so, does that make me take it less seriously? Even me, I hear myself doing this when I trail off into a point that I see people's reactions and I think, oh, I hope I'm not offending anybody. And my voice kind of goes, oh, so yeah. Just that is like such a gendered thing that I do. And it's because I've, for so long, had to be concerned with being taken seriously or having come off too strong. Mm-hmm. So... Mm-hmm. But yeah,
any final thoughts from you, Lindsay?
Hopefully things go back to normal, but the level of discourse takes a nice step up.
Agreed. Any final thoughts, Lindsay?
Thank you so much for having me.
No, thank you for making time.
I'm saying so many nice things. I really miss you. And Scott, it was so nice to meet you.
Likewise.
Facebook friend me.
All right. We'll do.
All right. Thank you again, Lindsay.
All right. Bye, guys.
Take care.
Bye. I want to thank everyone for listening to the Quality Under Pressure podcast. You can connect with us on Twitter at QUP Podcast. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram at Quality Under Pressure. And yes, I was going to say qualityunderpressure.com, but that's not right. Okay. Goodbye.